Log Talk Radio.
Mike Hart from Cole Brothers today. He has the interview with us.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by Joking Jerry Oates and Battling Bobby Simmons. How you guys doing this evening?
Good. What an intro, brother.
Yeah, we're doing good.
I'm running out of adjectives.
If you run out of adjectives, we're afraid you'll start telling the truth, and then we may really be in trouble.
We must be very limited, Bobby.
No, that's
I
right.
Know I am.
There's
I'm only, speaking from
only so many J's and B's. Now I can come up with plenty of adjectives. They just don't have a good ring to them.
So how are you guys doing? Good.
I'm doing wonderful. It finally got springtime again here in Atlanta today. It got up to about 80 degrees the last 2 days. Yesterday it was cold. It was 60.
I'm telling you.
It's been about the same here. It hasn't changed much.
Yeah, the weather, it was the first few days of this week, it was chilly, I'm telling you. It felt great, though.
Yeah, oh, I loved it.
Yeah, it's been in the mid-70s here, and it creeped up to 81 today. It's been the highest it's been all week, and I think it's probably creeping towards the 90s next week.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're talking right at 90 over the weekend here, so.
How's your gas situation up there, Bobby?
It's come down just a little bit. It's running 380 in that range. I heard today on the radio they said out in Conyers just east of Atlanta it was down to, in some places, headed for 370 something. So.
Oh, you think you're stealing it at 370?
I'm telling you. Yeah. Did you ever, 30 years ago, did you ever think you'd think 370 was cheap?
Bobby, I know when gas, this was the early 70s, just started creeping up. And I told my dad, I said, if this stuff ever goes to 50 cents a gallon, I'll never buy another gallon.
Mm-hmm.
50 cents.
Yep. As a kid,
hey,
I remember
line up uncle. Around the block for 50 cents.
You'd have to call it a riot squad, man.
Yeah, when I was in high school, $2, you could ride all night.
I know, man. It's, and the people's, incomes didn't go up enough to justify all this.
Yeah.
We're all in the same boat, though, so I can't.
I remember my uncle when I was a little kid. The neighborhood I grew up in, there was a mom-and-pop grocery store on every corner.
That's true.
He would send me to the store to get his cigarettes. Go buy me a pack of cigarettes. And, back then, they'd sell them to anybody. So I'd go, and I can remember him telling me, if they ever get to 50 cents, I'll quit. Then, if they ever get to 75, I'll quit. If they ever get to a dollar, I'll quit. When he died about 10 years ago, he was still smoking, of course. But I noticed in Vegas this year, in the vending machine there in the casino, cigarettes were $9 a pack.
Oh, come on, Bobby Simmons.
$9 a pack out of a vending machine in Vegas. Can you imagine?
Well, see, that right there doesn't make sense because the people who need to smoke out in Las Vegas are the ones who are nervous because they lost all their money. They can't afford $9 a pack.
Listen,
that's a good one.
I tell people all the time, my mom smoked, my dad smoked. I was very close to my uncle. He smoked. One thing I'm very proud of, I'm 56 years old, and I have never had one in my mouth.
I've never smoked either, Bob.
I just never saw the allure.
I smoked for 7 years and quit when I was 14.
Well, now, this you're going to think this is a lie. My wife is sitting right here. Her grandfather started her smoking when she was four.
Oh, come on.
I was seven.
Taught her how to roll Prince Albert out of a can and thought it, I mean, of course, now we're talking 1959, 1960 in that neighborhood. You know, they thought it was cute back then. And, of course, everybody, you know, even the TV star smoked and everybody thought, you know, but that was a, she smoked until about 12 years ago, maybe. And she'll tell you today, she won't tell you she's quit. She just hadn't had one in 12 years.
Well, I can still remember the first time I ever had one. I was 7 years old. I was coming back. I had this guy was dating my aunt at the time. They eventually got married and divorced. But he had carried me to see Bambi. And on the way home, he drove a Mustang. And on the way home, he had a cigarette in his mouth. And he said, "You want one?" I said, you know, typical 7 year old. I said, "Sure." So he lit me one up. There we go. And when I was in junior high school here in Mobile, there was a gas station that was right catty corner from the school campus. And I was always big for my age, and even when I was 13, 14 years old, I was over 6 feet tall. So I would go in there, and the guy that would sell me cigarettes out of the gas station, come to find out I married his daughter about 11 years later. See, she may have been the one selling me cigarettes for all I know. She worked there for her dad for a while, but yeah, it finally got to where I never could afford them because I'd save up and buy a pack, and then all my friends who didn't have any money would bum cigarettes from me, and I'd end up with nothing. So I said, "Well, this ain't worth it," so I quit.
It was a losing situation, wasn't it? Man.
Mm-mm-mm. I can remember some of the kids in my neighborhood, and of course I was too afraid of my mama, I think, was one thing to try some of this stuff. But I remember somewhere they came up with a plug of that Bull of the Woods chewing tobacco. And we were sitting, and there was a buddy of mine's dad owned the gas station. We were sitting on the curb in front of the gas station, and it was closed. And they decided to try that Bull of the Woods. And me and another guy had to help two other ones home because they couldn't walk. I mean, it was just...
It turned you green, man.
Listen, every way but loose. They said, one of them told me that the gas pumps were floating, and I went, "Sure they are. Let's go home."
Well, some of the kids that I hung around with in high school rode motorcycles. And we had this one guy. He had... I don't know if his leg was deformed or what, because I never saw him in shorts or anything, but he walked with, he drug one leg behind, and he kind of wobbled when he walked. And he was one of those that had the motorcycle. We were all out playing softball one Sunday afternoon, and he was hanging around. Of course, nobody's ever let him play because he couldn't run. But he got the wild idea, and he screwed the cap off of his gas tank on his motorcycle and stuck his face down in it. And breathing low stents, and I swear he walked straight for 100 yards.
Maybe I need to go snort some.
But well, you talking about chewing tobacco. I was amazed when I got in the wrestling business how many guys dipped. You know, we talked about Boyette last weekend, last week, smoking a cigarette. But they were. The funniest thing to me was one of the times I was in it and doing TV and TDS, and Flair was there, and this was when they were pushing him to making the world champion. He hadn't won it yet, but and of course he always wore those either white or baby blue three-piece suits and all this stuff and silk shirts and all that stuff, and he'd come out of doing an interview about how prim and proper he was and how, you know, all this and all this, and he'd come back there and strip down to his pants and dip that, put that snuff in his mouth, and I'm like, "Well, I just blew your image right there with me."
There you go, Flair, Dip.
Yeah, he, more than I know, he still does. Of course,
I'll tell you a story that Mike, that Rocket told me that happened there in Mississippi. He said they did a deal one night. He said, you know, if you ever saw Rocket chew tobacco, it looked like a baseball in the side of his mouth. I mean, he was the first person I ever met that could have a have a wad the size of a baseball in his mouth and drink water and never mix the two. I mean, it was crazy. But he said he was sitting one night in the back there somewhere in Mississippi, and Armand Hussein, I guess, who was a big black baby face down there at the time, he said that they did a deal where him and Flash ran in on him. And he said when he ran in, he said he forgot that he had that tobacco in his mouth. And he said he don't really know where the thought came from. It's just one of those things that happened. He said, but he run in the ring, and he said when they was putting the boots to Hussein, he was laying on his back. And he said his mouth was open. And Rocket said, I just leaned over, and he said, I just eased that wad of tobacco out. And he said, I just dropped it right in his mouth. And he said Hussein went to coughing and gagging and yakking, and he said the people started screaming, he's poisoned him. And he said, of course, he was laughing so hard, he said he couldn't do nothing, he just lay up. But he said he just ran in there and dropped it right in his mouth. Can you imagine? Oh.
Yeah, I remember he always had a big chew like that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, just sit there and drink ice water and chew that tobacco. Oh,
he was a talented person.
Multi-talented. Oh.
Well, guys, I'm going to get our guest on with us here in just a second. I'm going to dial up Jim Lancaster, who, Gary, I don't know if you remember him or not, but you actually wrestled Jim a couple of times.
I guess I did.
76. And he and Ted went around the horn and even came to Dothan together.
I hadn't seen him years.
Oh. Jim.
Yes.
Hey, it's Michael. How you doing this evening?
Doing all right.
Got Bobby and Jerry on the line with us as well.
Okay.
Just give everybody an introduction. This is Big Jim Lancaster, who came out of Blue Pines Gym and started his career working for the Sheik. And I was doing a little digging through the stuff. Jim was nice enough to send me a list of some of the places he worked and some of the matches he had. And I didn't realize you worked a lot more places than I realized. And besides Detroit, I didn't realize that you did TV for the WWWF, well, St. Louis, Kansas City, Tennessee, Tri-State, which was with Billy Golden and Buddy Wayne's promotion out of Montgomery, the Mid-Atlantic, Florida, Georgia, and the wonderful metropolis of Dothan, Alabama.
Well, guys, it's
so
good to be
here. How did you get started in the business?
Well, It started way back when I was just a kid, actually. I did what the wrestling promoters in this country have always wanted the fans to do. I drank the Kool-Aid. I was a believer. I hated the Sheik. I liked Bobo Brazil. This was back in the mid-60s kind of thing. And I was a real fan there for a short period of time, and then you watch it long enough and close enough, you kind of start picking up on some things, and you thought it just became entertainment after that. But Lou Klein had a school in Allen Park, Michigan, which is on the south side of Detroit, and I always kind of wanted to be a wrestler. Home life and everything, and made me wanted to hit the road early. So 3 days after I graduated high school in 1972, I headed north up to Louis Gym.
Are you from Detroit originally, or are you from Ohio originally?
No, Dayton, Ohio was where I was born and raised. Yeah, and it was probably about a 2.5-hour, 3-hour trip, something like that, to get up there. So it wasn't an exhausting ride, but it's far enough away from home to kind of be on your own and try to learn the trade that you wanted to be part of. And it was through him I made connection, came to know the Sheik and, you know, how the promotion worked and who it was and all of that type of stuff. So it certainly was an eye opener, and kind of in a hurry for me, because I kind of got smartened up pretty quick.
Now, there was a lot of guys that came out of Klein's gym. I know that's when people talk about, you know, training centers like Gagne's and, you know, Stu Hart's,
yeah.
People like that. But there was a lot of people,
yeah.
both guys, yeah. and girls that came out of Klein's gym.
Yeah. There was, when I was there, I was, it was kind of at its peak, I think, when I went in there. Boy, Hondo was there at the time, a guy named Jerry Novak. They later became the Bounty Hunters in Tennessee, and I think they worked in Florida and Indianapolis and Detroit. I know they ended up back up there. And there was two guys that ended up from Klein's gym. It hooked up with Bobby Shane down in Georgia. If you remember, he had a valet named Winston.
Yes, I remember Winston.
It goes back a ways, and they had a guy named Greg Lake, who was working as Bobby Sheen's protege. Watts was the booker at that time, but they came from Klein's gym. That was, I was trying to think when the heck that was, they were down there for a while, and May to August of 73, I understand, is what Greg Lake's telling me, but... Yeah, they were there. Mickey Doyle was there. He was down in Alabama for a while. Yes,
yeah,
in the California
Kiwis. Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Mickey didn't work a lot of territories, did he?
Who was that?
Mickey. He didn't work. This is Jerry. Jim.
Yeah.
Mickey didn't work a lot of territories, did he? He wasn't in the business long.
He was in. I know he went to California and Kansas City. Yeah, he was in the business a long time, but he didn't travel all that long, I don't think. He was, I know he was in Kansas City with Mike Boyette. I think that's where the California Hippies thing started, and then from there.
Actually, that started here in Mobile. Mickey was down in Tampa, and I think it was Bobby Shanks suggested he was finishing up in Tampa. And he wasn't real sure where he was going to go. And at the time, he had grown a beard, and his hair was going long. And Bobby said, "You look like Mike Boyette. Call Lee Fields and go up there." So he called up here and talked to Bob Kelly, came in, and he did. He looked a lot like Mike, so they put the two of them together. They had a long run. They were together in here. Mickey came in here in March of 72. Was here through the summer of 72. Then they left together. They went to work. They briefly worked in Tennessee, and then they went to Kansas City together. And from there, they split up. Boyette went out to L.A. for a brief time and then came back here. Mickey came back in 73 and was here again for about 4 months. They put the two of them back together, and then he left again. And he worked out in San Francisco. They put him under a hood in San Francisco and tried to make him a luchador. But he kind of homesteaded back in Detroit and finished up. Even after the Sheik went out of business, he worked a lot of the smaller promotions there.
He worked for me quite a bit when I was running some promotions up here in Ohio. He's living up in northern Michigan now, in the Upper Peninsula up there, and he was working some shots, I think, probably even as much as a year or two ago. But,
oh, really?
Yeah, but it was he knew it was time to get out of the ring. He was hurting too much to stay in. So I got a feeling that he's not taking too many more bumps nowadays.
He was a good worker. He was smooth as silk, and it was so odd. You know, he and Boyette looked so much alike, but Boyette's wrestling style, he was all knees and elbows. You think Mick Foley? I think Mick Foley stole all of his moves from Mike Boyette because they worked about the same way.
Yeah.
And even though Boyette could wrestle when he wanted to, but he was just so unorthodox, and Mickey was just so smooth and was such a good mat wrestler and could do flying stuff, and they just they made a good team. I think had Mickey been able to put up with Michael more, they'd have gone, could have been worked on top anywhere, but they just
I heard a lot of good things about that team. I never had the pleasure of meeting Mike Boyette, but I heard a lot of good things about that team. Mickey was certainly happy to his days that he was with Mike, so that worked out really good. But
they certainly were over here. So, and you also, it's something you and Jerry haven't told me, both of you guys worked in St. Louis. That hard rain.
I said, you and Jerry have something in common. You both worked in St. Louis in that hard rain up there. Yeah, it was. St. Louis was an interesting TV. I couldn't figure out some of their booking sometimes there because they would call us in from Detroit to do jobs sometimes, and they come in and they would put us over on TV. Now they would sometimes. You know, they would obviously beat us in a later date, but that was where I almost hooked up with Jerry Blackwell, as his brother was at St. Louis. Made our first connection there. St. Louis was for town. I only ended up with about two or three house shows, I think, out there, but hopefully Jerry got a few more.
Yeah, you know, the amazing part about that place, that was one of the greatest wrestling towns I ever wrestled in. And they had two of the worst rings that you would ever get in. That TV ring and that ring at the Kiel, that was a 24-foot boxing ring. You remember that, Jim?
That was part of the rock, man. I guess that was supposed to be part of the legitimate book of the whole thing, watching guys really get hurt out there on that.
I guess so. I mean, when you got slammed in that TV ring, I mean, you get slammed there, man, you couldn't move.
That's right. You knew it.
It jarred everything in you.
Yeah.
And why they had such sorry rings, I'll never know.
I don't know either. Probably just because he owned them and he didn't want to rent anything else.
I guess so. You're living in Ohio now?
Yeah. I live in a town called Sidney, Ohio, which is about 50 miles north of Dayton. I don't know if you're familiar where Dayton's at. We're just about 95 miles north of Cincinnati, if that helps you anymore. But
Right on
I-75, yeah. Living up here. And my daughter up here, she's a blessing. She just turned 18. She's going to graduate high school next week.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I got two daughters that God's really blessed me with, and I'm so happy with her. Stacy and Jennifer, and Stacy is so good in her faith and her grades. She's going to do good when she gets to college next year. And my oldest daughter, Jennifer, she's 13 years older than Stacy. She's over in Bahrain right now. She's a doctor in the Navy.
And, no kidding.
Yep, she's serving over there right now. She's coming home here about the middle of June. And
I know you'll be glad of that.
Oh, yeah, I'll be glad to see them. They live down, she and her husband live down in Jacksonville, Florida. I'll certainly be glad to see them. That's for sure. I've truly been a blessed man.
But when did you get out of the business full time?
Well, I tell you, Georgia was the last place I worked full time. It was.
Is that right?
Yep, it was the end of '76 when I finished up in full time. I had a couple serious injuries down in Georgia.
It wasn't because you worked with me, was it?
No.
Oh, you were not a referee.
I think if he says anything about the referee, I'm hanging up.
Nope. In fact, I was hurt so bad, the referees helped me both that night. It might have been you, Bobby. I don't know, but I can't remember the times that I got hurt down there. But I finished up right at the end of '76. It's Andre the Giant hurt me one night, believe it or not. And another one was Gino Hernandez. know if you remember him or not.
I don't. I know Gino, and I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah, I was fixing to say that doesn't come as a great shock.
Well, I tell you, I think Gino must have thought that he was cursed with me or something, because the first night in the territory, I worked with him in Augusta on August the 30th of 76, and he wanted to do this finish called a victory roll. I'm a big man and a heavy guy, and I told him, I said, I've never done that before. I don't think I can do it. I don't feel confident in that. We want to get you over, they want to get you over strong and everything. Can you use another finish that, can make you look pretty strong? He was insistent. No, he wanted that, and I was going to do it, and it was going to be all right and all this other kind of stuff. Well, you can imagine how it went. And it just... And I ended up sitting on top of him or something. I don't know what the heck it was, but the fans got a chuckle out of it. He just fumed over as he normally would, I guess. And he was always a guy that he always felt he was privileged over everybody else for some reason.
You just nailed it right there. He did.
Yeah. And
the last
I
time
hope
I go ahead.
Go ahead.
The last time I saw him was when I was leaving Oregon. That was the last time. That was in 1978. That was the last time I saw him.
Yeah.
And he had just come in out there, and he had that arrogance about him, and I don't know.
Yeah.
He could have really done some great things, but...
Yeah. He had some skills. He just didn't have the head to go with it. But,
no, he did not. A good-looking kid, and, and just...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but we messed up that finish, and we rode in the car one night going to Athens, and Paul Orndorff was driving some little rattle trap of a car, and gosh darn, was coming back and had a flat tire out in the country somewhere. I don't know where the heck it was. And it was me and Hernandez and Orndorff. So we get in the trunk, and his spare tire's flat. So there's a heck of a thing that we got to do. So we start walking. It's 10, 11 o'clock at night. We're out in the country and all this other kind of stuff. I walk up on a guy's porch. Could have got myself killed. I was trying to get the guy to call the sheriff's office for us to have him send somebody out. And we kept walking. We found some closed gas station. We sat down in front of this gas station. Next thing we know, this cop comes flying by in a car. And I'm thinking, hell, I can't even get arrested with this guy. So I don't know what the deal was. And Rick Steamboat came and got us that night. And they took us back to the jailhouse, and we all kind of stood there like we were criminals. But I don't know whatever happened to Orndorff's car. I think he just left it there. But that was nice. But I tell you, I was working with Hernandez. It was in the town. It was on a Saturday night. Now, if I got this wrong, you guys help me out here. Did they run Griffin on a Saturday night?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
We used to run Griffin on a Saturday night.
Because right.
I remember so little about the incident. All I know is Hernandez wanted a body slam during that match. And I tried to, I tried to be cooperative and work with guys the best I can. So I said, what the heck, I'm just a jobber here, so thought we'll give it a shot. And he picked me up for a body slam and dropped me right straight down on my head.
Oh, jeez.
And my neck just jammed into my shoulders, and it knocked me out in the ring. And I woke up when the referee was putting the three count in. So obviously he was smart enough to cover me, and I didn't know where I was at or nothing, and the referee had to help me out. Back to the dressing rooms, and I don't know who that referee was, because I can't remember. I couldn't remember what town I was in.
It's probably Doug Smith, because Doug lived in Griffin. He used to work there on Saturdays a lot.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell the incident. He the thing that got him run off from Georgia, he was in Griffin working with somebody, and he was supposed to get some color.
Uh-huh.
And he thought it would be cute to cut the referee, and he cut Doug Smith.
Oh,
and when
Lord.
He got in the dressing room, Doug Smith beat the ever-loving tar out of him.
Oh, come on, Bobby.
Oh, yeah, right there. I mean, Doug had him up against the wall and just smacked him around and told him he was no, he was on him bad. And that kind of ended the run here, and it only lasted maybe a month.
Yeah, I never heard that story.
Doug just like killed him.
But the other injury I had down in Georgia, and that was one that really kind of woke me up to make me start thinking about whether or not I needed to be in the wrestling business or not. But October 15th of 76 in Atlanta, I put over Ricky Steamboat on the undercard there at the auditorium, and then had a battle royal at the end, and Andre the Giant was in. And Andre picked me up like he was going to give me a slam, and he just kind of told me, you know, it's like he usually does, let's go, boss. You know, and he walked over the rope, and he let me over. He just kind of laid me over the rope real easy. But when he did, I don't know, he lost his grip or something, and my tailbone hit the side of the ring, and I went down on the floor, and I lost a feeling in my legs for about 30 seconds. I just couldn't move. I didn't know what the heck was going on. And whoever was refereeing on the floor that night came over and asked me if I was all right. And I told him that, and he helped roll me under the ring, because about the time they did, Gene Anderson was coming over the top rope right on top of me. So I certainly appreciate that referee that night, and it took everything I had to stand up and walk to the dressing room. And man, that in fact, that still hurts me today. I've got a few, some disc problems in my lower back, I think, came from that incident. But
I'm sure that's what it's from.
But I really started putting some thought. You know, is this a business I need to be in? You know, and I really started putting it together, because you know, wrestlers have got to, you know, you can tell your fans and your family how good you are and all that kind of stuff, but you know, you really have to face facts. When if you're not good enough, you just kind of need to come clean with yourself and know that. That was a wake up call for me, that maybe I didn't have what it took to really make the good money in wrestling. And my wife was wanting to come in off the road anyway, and she didn't like the traveling too much, and that injury with Hernandez, and you know, and you don't have any medical insurance, so you don't go to the hospital or nothing. You just kind of shake it off and go to the next town. You know, I've still got neck pain today and tailbone pain, and that was it. Man, I was, you know, I came home and I said, that's it. You know, the wife was the final straw. She wanted me to get off the road. So we came in, and in 77, I moved to a little town called Wapakoneta, Ohio, which nobody's heard of, just north of Sydney here a little bit. And it's a town that Neil Armstrong is from, that old, the astronaut that walked on the moon kind of guy.
No kidding.
Yep. So they got him as their favorite son instead of me. But
well, that's a shame.
Well, Jim, you kind of set this up, and I was trying to be nice, but I've got to ask. You said that you drank the Kool-Aid and you hated the Sheik and you liked Bobo. After you got in the business, did your opinion change any?
After I got in the business, I hated Sheik's kid worse than I hated the Sheik. It was interesting. I was 18 years old. I was fresh right out of high school, and I had known for a couple of years. You know that it's a work, and you know that they're cooperating with each other and all this other kind of stuff, but you just don't know how it's really being done.
That's exactly right.
And once you get in, and you're still kind of bug-eyed about some of the people that you're working with and stuff like that. And Bobo was one of the first guys I worked with, and that turned out to be pretty good. But the Sheik, he didn't have a lot of time or patience to talk to the jobbers or the newcomers and all that other kind of stuff. And he dressed by himself and everything. He sent his kid out to give everybody the bad news, and he was just a knucklehead that you'd ever want to deal with. I don't know if you ever ran into him or knew him or not, but he tried to be the Sheik without being the Sheik, so he he thought he had the same influence as Dad did, and it just didn't work. But I got to work with all the guys that kind of set at ringside, you know, paid to see for a while, you know, Bull Curry and Johnny Valentine, and worked with the Sheik one time up in Hamilton, Ontario.
Was Fred Curry up there when you
had I'm sorry, go ahead, Bobby.
That was Jerry.
Was Fred Curry up there then?
Fred Curry, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's there. Yeah, I've never met him, but.
Yeah. You know, actually, speaking of Fred Curry, I was in Georgia three times before I came in 76. And I didn't realize that until I started looking over all these old booking lists and stuff like that when, you called and said you wanted me to be on the show, and I was just kind of refreshing my memory. But I came in October 26th of 74, worked TBS. Harley Race brought me in. I was working Tennessee at the time. That shocked the heck out of me. It's my first plane ride, but out of Nashville to Atlanta. And I can't even remember who I put over. I might have done a wrestling two or somebody, maybe something like that. But I don't know if you fellows recall the very first, this would have been in January of 75, the very first IWA tapings in Savannah.
I remember
Eddie
that.
Eddie Einhorn and George Cannon and all those guys, Pedro Martinez came down. That was the first big, you know, that was a thing Vince would do later, but they tried to go national and really, you know, really make an impact. I was one of the guys who went in for their TV taping the first time down there in Savannah. And you talk about an all-star team, man. Those dressing rooms were packed. And you could just tell there was too many stars in the dressing room that was going to lead to trouble. But that's what
happened.
They seemed to enjoy beating the crap out of us that night. But we had to hold still for it. But later that year, in July 10th, 11th, and 12th, I was a tag team champion down in Georgia. And I think I'm the only person that remembers it. I don't know my partner. Probably Fred Curry and Thunderbolt Patterson were running shows together, and I was hooked up with Fred up here in Ohio, and he decided to send us down in Savannah, Statesboro, and Noonan, and I was working under the name of Smasher Stone, and my partner was Mad Dog Sarnas, who was an old timer by the name of Bob Hamby. I don't know if anybody knows
him. Oh yeah, I remember Bob Hamby. I never met him, but I've seen his name.
Yeah, and we worked with the McGuire brothers down there every night.
Jerry's favorites. See, Jerry, you complained about teaming with him. Boy, Jim had to work be in the ring.
Well, at least I was on their side.
Man, you choose in their corner, you get lost, brother, I tell you.
Jim may not remember this, and he really didn't have anything to do with this little incident, but I was refereeing one night, and Jim was working with Bill Howard. And Bill Howard's one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. He said things, and I don't even think he tried to be funny, but Jim had him in a headlock. And I could hear him calling me, and I was walking around, and I could hear him going, Bobby, Bobby. And I don't remember where we were, but I finally ducked down under there where I could see him. And he was in this headlock, and he told me, he goes, look at that little kid on the front row. He said, don't he look like Opie from Andy Griffith? I thought, nowhere else but this business would have gone.
Yeah, Howard, Bill was an interesting character. He, we lived in, when I was in Georgia for Barnett there, we lived in Jonesboro. That little burg just up in Atlanta there. And Bill Howard and Stan Stasiak and I, we all lived in the same complex there. And our families got together and wives and had cookouts and played tennis and all that other kind of stuff. You can imagine somebody my size playing tennis. It went pretty slow, I can tell you that. But I tell you, some of my, you know, I talk about my injuries down in Georgia and do you know what Amanda is and all that kind of stuff. But some of my neatest memories come from down there too. You know, I was really, really blessed. Had the opportunity to work with some good guys and some big names. You know, it was a little town, but one night me and Stan Stasiak worked with Dean Ho and Ricky Steamboat. Now, you know, for just a little name in the business like me, that's a big deal. And I don't know. I just feel blessed to have that opportunity to work with those guys and that type of thing. But in fact, the biggest win of my career came in Athens, Georgia. That was on November 18th of 76. My team to Killer Brooks, and they put us over Haystack Calhoun and Tom Jones. And the thing of it is, Ole Anderson didn't like either one of those guys, Haystacks or Jones. So I think he was more punishing them than rewarding us, I think, by putting us over them. We were there. Jerry, were you at the meeting when the Anderson brothers came in and they called all the guys in and introduced them as the Bookers and all that kind of stuff? Were you at that meeting? Do you recall?
No, I was. Ted and I were in Japan.
Oh, okay.
I was.
Were you there? Okay.
Yeah, I was there. Talk about when we met down in at the sports arena down in that little meeting room?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about it. I wasn't there. Let me hear it.
Oh, well, I can only tell it from my perspective. I knew Ole from when I was working up in Charlotte, and he didn't care for fat guys. So I knew that I wasn't long for being on the roster. And sure enough, he asked me, Tom Jones, and Pork Chop Cash to stay after the meeting. They wanted to talk to us. And I knew what that was. If I had a cell phone back then, I could have called my wife, told her to start packing. But sure enough, that's what it was. They said, well, you know, we haven't got room for all the guys and all this other kind of business. And I was the first one called in for that meeting. Years later, when Georgia started running matches up in Ohio and Michigan, they started making them tours up through here. I was at a show in Grand Rapids, and I got there early, and everybody else got there late. So I'm sitting there by myself, and the first guy to walk in is Ole Anderson. So he reluctantly shook hands with me, but we got to chatting and everything. And I said, you probably don't remember. I said, but I'm the first guy you ever fired in your career as a booker. And he that was my claim to fame, right? So he said, and he looks at me, and he says, no, you're not. I said, he says, Tony Parisi. He said, he just got mouthy with me, and I had to get rid of him right away. Because they gave me a 2-week notice, and he said I'm sorry, you aren't the first guy. So that was it. My other, you know, busting my bubble, man. That's the only claim to fame I've got down there with him.
Put you in good company. Only fired everybody.
Really?
One form.
And you're not by yourself.
Yeah, there was a lot of us. I'm sure.
When you got off the road full time, did you work anymore?
Yeah, I became a weekend warrior. I started back working for Fred Curry, worked a few shots for Sheik, got in contact with, stayed in contact with Bruiser. I'd already been working for Dick the Bruiser for a while, getting some shots from him, and just started, you know, calling out to St. Louis and just calling around and see if there's anything that could, you know, get some work, you know, just right there, you know, from home type of thing. And then I hooked up with some other local promoters in Indiana and that type of thing. So we stayed busy a little bit. Sheik was close to getting out of the business at that point, so there wasn't much left for him. But when he closed up in 80, there's a lot of people tried to promote up in Detroit, you know, little guy, you know, little promoters and stuff like that. But big boys, just, you know, it was Georgia would come through and that type of thing. But stayed busy. But that's when I got into the newspaper business. Was when I came in off the road and ended up became a newspaper reporter. Yeah. And I still ask, that's what I say to myself every morning before I go to work now. No kidding. You're really a newspaper reporter. But I started at the local newspaper there. They needed somebody to help out to write high school sports on the weekends and stuff. So, hey, it was $25. I was used to that. I got 15 for TV, so I was getting more money going to a high school basketball game than working TV matches someplace. And I started working part time selling newspaper subscriptions door to door. You know, I knock on the door and tell them, "Hey, I wrestled Andre the Giant. You want to buy a newspaper?" It was a real humbling experience, but I ended up just kind of getting to know people and stuff, and writing a lot of different sports things. And the sports editor left. They offered me the job, and I started doing that, and just expanded, and just kind of learning the business, just like you did in wrestling. You know, you get your sneaky way in any way you can.
Exactly.
You know, the high percentage of us doesn't really get trained properly, but we still get in the business, and it takes a while to, you know, to work your way through it and figure out, you know, what to do and stuff. And it's been a while now, but I've won 5 writing awards from state writing awards and different things like that. And I'm pretty. I hate to sound prideful. That's kind of a sin to do, but. I'm really happy with it, you know, that type of thing. And I'm still in it today. I'm coming off a couple of years of, I really kind of had some hard times that I was dealing with. I had some health issues, and I had some periods of unemployment here, and the mother of my children passed away, and we kind of had a lot of different things happen right row for us. That it was hard for me to remain faithful, but my daughter kept me on track. My daughter, who just turned 18, you know, continued to keep me strong in my faith and continue to tell me that God's going to show us a way, and He is. And I've been blessed here recently. I just started a new job, and it's going to open the door to other things. And without her reminding me every day, man, I think I'd have lost it. But I'm so thankful. I don't want to go off on that tangent. I know we're not here to talk.
No,
about
that's
that.
Fine, man. I mean, it's interesting to hear people's stories. I mean, we've all had some blows, Jim. I'll tell you that. I mean, I've had my share, and I've been blessed. I have.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a rough row to hoe the last year, but I'm doing well now. I'm doing better than I thought I would ever be doing again, and it's I'm just blessed, like you said. I'm blessed, like you are. You know,
it's just hard before you get down, and you try to be proud, like a wrestling day. You know, you try to be proud of the job you did at the time and everything, but it's just hard to look back and stay focused on today. And you're right. You know, when you're able to look back and know that you're blessed, it does motivate you to keep going.
It really does. It really does. And I'm glad things are working out for you, man. Really. I mean that.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, we got a couple of callers in here. I'll get them on the line. Let us see if they've got any questions for you guys.
Okay.
Tony, you're on the line. Go ahead.
This me? Am I on the line?
Yes, you are. Who am I speaking with?
This is Greg Lake. Jim's old alma mater. I thought he was going to be on the show tonight. I had to call and say, hey, Jim is one of the best promoters, and I'm not just saying it to kiss up to him. I have no reason to. He's one of the best promoters and best guys I've ever known in the business. First man I ever met in the business. The guy's great, super worker. I still have a match from Wrestling at the Chase with me and Al Snow against Big Jim and what's his face?
Jerry Blackwell,
yeah. And Blackwell just beat the crud out of us, and Jim sold a little bit. Don't make fun of Little
brother.
Eddie. Little Eddie is my Facebook friend. Pardon?
Oh,
sorry.
Oh, jeez. Well, I'll pray for you, brother. That's for sure.
Hey, Jerry Oates.
Yes. Yes.
You know me. I was Bobby Shane's protege. You probably don't remember me back in 73. Jim mentioned it earlier. And I was in there for a couple months. I might even have worked with you once or twice.
I remember.
But you know what?
Many years ago.
Yeah, oh yeah, 73. The last time I saw you live, you were working for Don Owens. You were in the Crow's Nest, and you had a shirt that said potato on it. And I remember that flashed back a lot of memories with the potatoes, I'll tell you. I'm messing with you.
Hope not none for me.
Oh, and Ole Anderson, he's a real, well, I can't say what he is on the air, but he treated me like crud. But anyway, God bless him. I pray for him, I'll tell you. But anyway, I just wanted to say hi to everybody, and especially Jim, and you picked a good friend.
Good to hear from you, Greg.
One more thing real quick, I'll let you go. Jim was there. The first show I ever worked, Cleveland TV, I worked with Greg Valentine the first match when he was with the Fargo Brothers, and the same day, second tape, I worked with Johnny Valentine. So I worked with the two stiffest people in the business my very first show.
I was going to say, that was the first one, and you came back for a second one? That's good.
I had to have been crazy.
But the rest of your career was downhill from there, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, I'll let you guys get back to your talk, and I'm enjoying the show.
Appreciate it, man.
Thank
God bless you all. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Keep listening.
Thanks, sir.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling,
Bye-bye.
Greg.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Jim. God bless.
Got one more, too. Let me get the one here for us real quick. Caller from area code 214. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you guys doing tonight? Tom Ernesto on this end.
Hey, Tom. What's up, Junior?
I am in Lanceboro, Massachusetts, promoting the circus, doing it all again.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Listen,
it's cold, it's rained for a week, the whole deal, but I'm still here.
I really don't care. I ain't got my cannon ride yet, brother.
Right, we'll get you that cannon ride, brother. I wasn't there. If that had been my town, I'd been at your doorstep. You'd been in
the cannon. Coming to Brunswick. I thought you were coming to Brunswick.
I thought I was too, but they sent me to Greenville, North Carolina, and Goldsboro, North Carolina, were my first shows. I didn't get to go to Brunswick.
I even got my Spaceman Frank Hickey uniform out.
Listen, Jim may not know what we're talking about. Tom Ernesto Jr. works for Cole Brothers Circus, and if he gets somewhere near Ohio, he's always looking for people to be shot out of the cannon, brother.
There's a cannon right there. I'm telling you, if I get up that way, there's a cannon right there. We'll put you right in it, shoot you right out of it.
And see, Jim, I volunteered to do it down here in Brunswick, Georgia, but I never got the call. I had my helmet and everything ready to go. I'll go take one more bump.
One more big one. Look out.
Now, Jim, I know you worked in Tennessee a couple of times. Was Tom Ernesto ever booking when you were in there, Tom Sr.?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm still here. Did we lose Jim?
I think we may have one.
Jim,
no,
I'm
here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Can you
hear me?
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I
was asking.
I didn't know.
The two times you worked in Nashville, out of Tennessee, a couple times, didn't you?
Yeah. Tom Ernesto wasn't there when I was in Tennessee, but he was in Atlanta when I came in there, because I just finished up in Florida, wrestled in Tallahassee on a Friday, and on the way out that night, they asked me, said, "Do you want to work Atlanta TV tomorrow?" So I said, sure. So I drove on up Atlanta on the way back to Ohio, and that was on July 31st of 76. And myself and a guy named Bill Costello, I don't know if anybody remembers that fellow or not, but we went out and worked with Dean Ho and Ken Mantell, who might have been the tag champions at the time. I'm not sure. I can't remember what I had for breakfast, so I don't know what the heck they were doing back then. But for some reason, Dean Ho and Ken Mantell decided to just work with us like they was working the main event. And we tore the house down. I mean, don't ask me why they decided to do that. We didn't talk about it. We didn't. We just kind of went out and did our thing, and they sold for us and put us over just as strong as they would any heels in territory. And Tom Ernesto met as we come out to, as we come out of there. And as soon as we got back there, where all the guys were dressing, Ernesto came up to me and he said, "You wanted me to stay." He said, "Can you stay in the territory?" He said, "I could really use you." And I thought, "Holy smokes!" I thought maybe some guys were pulling a rib on me or something like that, and I was going to agree to it and stay till Monday, and then nobody knew my name at that point. But I went home. I had a bookie for the Bruiser. I didn't want to turn him down. Plus, I needed to get back to Ohio for a little bit. And I ended up coming back in, and Tom brought me in, sure enough. And on August 16th of 76, I started first night in Augusta with a draw with Ted Oates.
No kid.
Yep, and that was a heck of a match. Ted really worked hard to kind of make me get my stuff over, and I really respected him for that. And I know
he'll appreciate that.
Yeah, in that time. So I don't know where he's at now, but say hello to him for me if you would.
I talk to him every day. He's living in Macon.
Okay.
He's got a lot of problems now, too.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He's had two neck surgeries, back surgery, four knee surgeries. He does all right, but, I mean, he it's like the rest of us, he's paying for it.
Got a shady older brother. That's, you know.
You know, we talk about all these injuries and stuff, and we know guys that's gone through a lot of stuff and all that business. And, you know, I'm not sure if I went back. I think I'd do it all over again, to tell you the truth. I don't know. I would not talk about that.
I'd do it again, too, but I'd do it different.
Yeah, I would. I wish I knew a little bit. The trouble with me and Greg Lake, when we were up there, see, Lou Klein really didn't train his guys. He provided a way to get in the business, but he didn't get in the ring with you and worked out. We trained each other. And how we basically did that is we'd watch the TV shows, and then we'd get in the ring and try to do that stuff. And that's why, you know, we ended up being jobbers, you know, out for Vince McMahon's here and St. Louis, a lot of different places, Cleveland and Pittsburgh.
And there was probably a lot of guys that really had the talent and just wasn't brought out in the beginning, you know. And it's really not fair to guys, you know. And I mean, Ted and I was blessed. Dickie trained us. Steinborn trained us. And,
uh-huh.
You know. And then when I trained somebody or Ted, we always trained guys the way we were trained. You know, the very beginning. And some guys just couldn't do it or didn't find out that this isn't for me, you know. But a lot of guys have gotten, I think, raw deals by the wrong people training them.
Yeah.
I can't speak for where you went because I never knew that gentleman. I've heard his name, of course, but, you know, I didn't know him or anything like that.
Yeah. But he was just, you know, he was just having guys pay him to train, and then he would just throw them in with the bus. And we would try to figure out what to do, try to figure out which end was up. And
right.
Most of these figured out, but.
Sounds like Lars Anderson school.
where did Bill Howard come out of? What school? Who trained him?
I'm not sure who trained him. He was out in Kansas City or guess he started up in Minneapolis, but I don't think he went to Vern Gagne's school. He started there somewhere. I think his roots were in Kansas City someplace. But I've lost track of him, and I'm not really sure of where he got started. But I remember when I started training some guys in the early 80s. I was wanting to get a promotion started and get my own guys, and there was four guys wanting to be trained, and so I started working out with them, and I vowed that I wasn't going to teach them, you know, like I was taught, but you know, he was going to learn how to do things. And one of the guys was Al Snow.
He turned out very good.
Yeah, he had a good run with Vince there for a while, and he's, I guess, he's still getting some spot shows every now and then, but he's living up in Louisville, Kentucky right now. But he was just one of those guys, you know, and Jerry, you've probably seen him come along too, Bobby and everybody there, that's just seen that, you know, they just have that natural talent. They just...
Exactly.
They just got that drive, and they got the talent, and they're gonna make it no matter how many doors get slammed in their face. And,
yep.
And he was one of them. And I like to, you know, I like to talk about having trained Al Snow, but I sure can't take credit for it. I mean, I can say it all I want to, but you know, he was self-driven, and he learned most of his stuff on his own. I taught him how to do the basics, work a match, and that kind of stuff.
Well, that's all you do, the basics, and they have to go from there. You know, like you said,
yeah.
If they got the talent, they'll pick it up.
Yep, they developed themselves, that's for sure.
We've talked about this several times on the show. You've also seen those guys, too, that have that God-given natural ability, but it never clicks between their ears.
Oh,
they
my.
They've got all the tools. They've got the ability. It just never clicks. And, I mean, just...
Yeah.
You wonder...
You wonder what happened.
Well, that...
Yeah.
You mentioned that, and while we've still got Tom Jr. on the line, Bobby, you told this story on here before, but Jim, I want you're very familiar with Zulu, right? Ron Pope?
Yeah. Oh, God, yes, I worked with him. Yeah.
Well, he had a little rib pulled on him by Tom Ernesto, and Bobby was there to witness it all, so I want Bobby to tell that story.
Oh, jeez.
Senior came up with some... Of course, you were around Tom. You know, Tom was funny. He looked like anything but a professional wrestler. He looked like a lawyer. He talked like a lawyer. He just, you know, and unless you knew Tom, you really didn't know what a wicked sense of humor he had. And he got some food coloring tablets. He had four or five different colors, and he started slipping them in Zulu's drinks. And he would put one color in, and he would, you know, do it for two or three days. And, you know, he'd come in, you know, and Tom had this, you know, hey, brother, hey, lover, how are you? How you feeling? You don't look good tonight. You're not feeling well. So Zulu finally bit and confided one night in Tom. He said, look, Tom, he said, I got this problem. He said, when I'm going to the bathroom and I'm urinating, he said, it's coming out blue. He said, I don't know why. And Renesco said, well, I got this doctor friend in Atlanta. I said, let me talk to him and I'll see. So you know. A couple of days goes by, and Tom starts feeding him some orange peels, you know, in his drinks and stuff. You know, the next week, Tom says, well, I talked to the doctor. He said, you know, the blue thing, you know. I mean, this rib probably lasted 6 weeks, and he was changing colors on him about every three or four days. And finally, Tom told him, he said, look, he said, I talked to the doctor. Finally, he figured it out. He said, he called it something. He said, look, he said, man. He said, if it ever, ever, ever turns black, he said, man, you ain't got but days to live. And sure enough, he finally fed him the black food colored pills. And I said, I thought Zulu was going to go crazy.
Oh, I could see that. Oh, man. That would be a fun one to follow. That would be.
Whatever happened to him?
I don't know. Last I heard, and this has been a long time ago, he was driving a cab in San Francisco or something.
Yeah, that's the last thing I heard about him, too.
That's been a long time ago.
Well, I thought you were leading to the story of him and Ole, where he showed up at the sports arena one day. I was in the ticket office in the front, and he came in the front door. And, of course, you know, when one of the guys came in, I never thought anything about it. I just, you know, threw my hand up, waved, and he went on back. They were back there, and all of a sudden I heard this screaming and yelling, and I went to open the door of the ticket office and look, see what was going on. And as I opened the door, Zulu was backing out of the back office. And as he's backing up, as he gets to where I can see, Zulu has a gun in his hand. And he's got it pointed at Ole, and Ole is about 3 or 4 inches from the barrel of the gun walking towards Zulu as Zulu is constantly backing up. And Zulu's hollering, I'm going to shoot you, I'm going to shoot you, I'm going to shoot you. And Ole's telling him he don't have guts enough to shoot him, calling him everything but a child of God. Zulu backed out the door of the arena. Ole walked him all the way down the sidewalk. Zulu got in his car, and when he drove off up the street, Ole was standing on the sidewalk cussing, and Zulu had the pistol out the window hollering, "I'm going to shoot you," as he drove off.
Jeez.
And that was the last time I ever saw him.
Oh, man, a lot. That just doesn't surprise me. That does not surprise me. That's nutty.
I was not working for Nick Goulas.
Well, jeez, man, I don't know how many. You haven't got too much time for that.
Are you farting through silk? I guess that's a.
Yeah. Oh, I heard that speech. Yeah. Yeah. The only people I had never heard him say that to was the McGuire brothers. it was a strange territory because they had that Jarrett Gula split. You know, they had the Memphis end, and then they had Nashville and Chattanooga, and that was Nick's doings. You know, you could be championing one end of that territory and doing jobs in the other end, but it was very obvious that, you know, he didn't respect his workers. I don't think he respected anybody, and I happened to be right at the peak of George Gulas in there working, and I had to work with him five or six times, and golly gosh, I'd rather work with Lou Fez than work with him. One of the biggest cards I worked on down there, Jack Briscoe came into Memphis to work with Lawler for the world title, and it was a big, you know, it was a big night. They sold every seat in the place and all this other kind of stuff, and I had to go out and work with him, with George Gulas, in the second match. All he wanted to talk about was a finish. He wouldn't talk about anything else. You know, well, do you want to do that? No. Just, I'll beat you like this. I'll beat you. That's what he was wanting. That's okay, great. That's fine. You know, your daddy owns the place. We'll just do it the way you want to do it. And we went out, and I got the guy in a wrist lock, just a wrestling hold. And he was so baffled by a heel putting a wrestling hold on him that it was just a standing wrist lock. And I'm waiting there, and I thought he was waiting for me to pull him down by the hair, and the next thing I knew, he just walked out of it. He just walked away. I mean, just like he was Hercules or something. He couldn't think of how to reverse it. He couldn't think of how to get out of it. He couldn't think of how to do anything else, so he just walked away. And I thought, well, because I thought he was trying to do some kind of move. And we both stood there like, you know, we got crap on our face or something. And I'm thinking, well, okay, well, it's time. This guy obviously doesn't know anything but get punched and kicked, so I might as well do that. That's how we did it. Went back to the dressing room. I went in to say thanks to him and, you know, shake hands with him after the match, and I walked in the babyface room there. He's looking in the mirror at his teeth, and his daddy is, Nick is standing beside him. He said, that son of a gun, and he didn't say son of a gun, but he said, "That fat son of a gun hit you in the mouth, son. Oh my God!" Well, that's it. Where's he at? I'm going to talk to him right now. And I'm going to do this. And I was standing right behind him, and I said, "George, you all right?" And he says, "Yeah, there's nothing wrong." And Nick was just fuming. And George fessed up, said nothing was wrong. I don't know what the heck he was doing. And that was my close encounter with Nick Gulas. It was pitiful. And then you work his towns, and gosh, okay. Bowling Green, Kentucky, you'd go there, you'd work an opener, then you'd manage the main event, and you'd beat a battle royal, and you'd get $15 for the night. Oh, Lord. it was just horrible. We worked, in, of all things, when they were pushing the bounty hunters down in Birmingham, this would have been the summer of 74, give us the straps down there, and I was managing them, and we was working with all people, Rufus R. Jones, who was great, But and George Gulas, I guess, you know, I guess the idea is to give somebody, you know, George to do it again. Well, they did a thing down there where they brought Jimmy Kent back in and put him with the baby faces. He was a Bounty Hunter's former manager, and they put Kent with the baby faces, and that was supposed to be the big equalizer, and the belts were held up and all this other kind of stuff and all this business. And that was a night I had a fan, and I had a fan come up, and this was got to be one of the most kayfabe fans I ever seen, because they just would go nuts, and they would talk about so-and-so, it's tough, so-and-so is, and all this other kind of stuff. And they looked at me, and they said, you guys are going to lose the belts tonight. You know, and I'm thinking, well, you know, get out of here, you know, this kind of thing. And they said, no, you're going to lose the belts because George Gulas is Nick's son. He isn't going to lose. Somebody's getting a look at the book. So we go out, sure enough, you know, we do the finish and all this business. And then they come back in and they tell us that we set an attendance record at this building. It was like 5,000 people or something, so whatever the heck it was. But it was a new attendance record. They sold out standing. And, of course, Nick wouldn't stop selling tickets, right? He didn't care what the fire marshal had to say. You know, if they had money in their hand and they were standing at the window, they got in. And so we went out and did this big finish, and, you know, everybody went home happy and all this other kind of business. And I got paid that night, $125. That's what me and each of the bounty hunters got for drawing 5,000 people if we got into that building. And right then I thought, you know, I don't know how much we have to draw for this guy to make $200. That'd be interesting to see, but it just didn't happen. And that's just, even when he was using you to make money, he didn't like you, so... I don't know. It was a strange thing, maybe. Jerry, did you ever work up there?
Never did.
No. Well, bless your heart, man, because you ain't missing nothing.
No, I was told never to go. I never made it.
But see, what you guys have forgotten is Nick had a saying, guys, it ain't what you make, it's what you save out of your check every week. That was his favorite saying. It ain't what you make, it's what you save out of your check every week. So, you know, you have to keep the facts in line, gentlemen.
Yes, that's true. I guess there is some truth to that. You know, we have to give the guru his due, I guess, on that one. But
No, I've cussed you many times over that very statement. many times over that very statement.
Hey, do you guys remember Pac Song? I have no idea. He's probably back in Korea now. I don't know, but
he's dead.
He passed away several years ago.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
I think he died in the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah, he had that giantism disease like Baba and Andre had, just not to that extreme.
Yeah.
But he had really, by the time he gotten out of the business, I think he was here, went home for something, and but he, I don't know if it was because of his Buddhist beliefs or whatever, but he wouldn't see a doctor here, and he got real sick and waited until it was time to, you know, had time to go home, and by the time he got home, you know, he was at death's door, and he passed away.
Yeah. Well, I sure didn't know that. Well, I sure hate to hear that. I was getting ready to tell a story about him. Maybe I shouldn't do that now. I don't know.
No, go ahead.
And Bobby, you might have had a hand in this one too. You remember somebody called me and said Pac Song needed to go to a dentist, and they needed somebody to take him. And he was living at the motel. I can't remember what the motel was at that time there in Jonesboro. And you know, he couldn't speak English, and had an infected tooth, and somehow somebody talked to him, agreeing into getting it taken out. And I was the one who chose. They asked me to go take him to the dentist. And I thought, well, you know, if the office wants you to take him, you'll take him. You know, that type of thing. And sure enough, I went over and picked him up, and we went to this dentist that somebody at the office had it set up. Whoever it was, tell us where to go. And that
Dennis got so scared. Back Song walked in there, and he's kind of mean looking when he's in a good mood, let alone when it's in pain. And he walked, we walked in, and I said, you know, I'm from the wrestling office, Spring Grove. Yeah, they do all about it. It was apparently, there was no other people in the place except the nurse and the dentist, so it must have been after hours or something. I don't know what it was, but that doctor got so scared. Pac Song, he had Pac Song set in the chair, and he was so big, he sat on the chair and put his feet flat on the ground, over the footrest, and the doctor would shake so bad. It wasn't until, because Pac Song was afraid of needles, and he said that infected, it's got to come out, and he was shaking. I mean, the guy was literally shaking, and that poor nurse was standing there. She didn't know what the heck to do, and he looked in there and pulled out. He's getting ready to numb that tooth, and Pac Song kind of put his hand up to stop him. And the doctor turned around, and I mean, this guy, he was almost in tears at this point. He says, tell him that this, you know, it's going to feel a little stick, but it's going to help us get the tooth out without any pain. I said, I'm not an interpreter, man. I'm just a driver. What are you looking at me for that? he said, you mean you can't tell this guy to hold still and not be scared when I'm hitting him with the stabbing him with the shot? And I said, no, you're on your own there, brother. And he said, oh, man. He laid everything down. He went out and walked around in the office. And Pac Song is just laying there. He's looking at me. I thought, man, if he turns on me, I'm hitting the road. Out of here. And finally, I went over, and I just said, okay. I guess he knew what the heck that meant. It's got to come out and all this. And that was my best Korean that I could come up with. Finally, I kind of just had to pat him on the hand. I said, well, leave it there. And finally, he consented to let this guy numb that tooth, and he pulled that thing out, man, and it looked like a leg bone. But that was horrible. And he says, whatever you do, don't let this, don't let him go to sleep for an hour. You know, he can't eat any hard food for the rest of the day. And just sips of water tonight, and then tomorrow, you know, if he wants to try something else, that's fine. He says, absolutely no dairy products for 48 hours, just because it'll get, the incision will get infected and all this other kind of stuff. I'm driving home, right? There's Pac Song, still all numbed up in my car, and he starts grunting and pointing at a convenience store, and I pointed, and he indicated that's where he wanted to go. So in he goes, he comes out with a gallon of milk. But I'm thinking, oh my God. He got in the car. I said, no. And he looked, and the only English word he said, drive. I said, please don't drink that. Just get back in your room. And I said, no, you can't. You're not supposed to do that. He said, drive. And I went back to his room. He got out with his gallon of milk, and I knew what he was. You knew he was going to go in there and drink down that whole thing. We had a little bit of time to sit and chat for a while, and the only thing I do remember was he missed his family so much. He was so lonely. And he had pictures of his wife and kids and stuff, and he showed up to me. Then I found out that they talked one time a week, because the phone rates at that time. They talked for an hour on Sunday. And he was just heartbroken. He missed his family. And after I left Atlanta, I didn't do that. But I certainly hope you made enough money to make that venture. I did not hear that he had passed. I did not hear that.
He was a good guy.
Yeah, he was. I never worked with him, but he looked, he looked like a good worker and take care of his guys he was working with and stuff.
He did.
Yeah, he was very, very easy. I mean, just being a referee, of course, I was on the end of a couple of those chops from time to time, but he was very easy to work with.
Yeah.
I remember they sent me to the store one time to get some watermelons for TV.
Uh-huh.
And I brought the watermelons back, and they told me they were for Pak Song, and he was going to, you know, I thought he was going to chop them or something. I didn't know what he was going to do. And I, you know, of course, I just asked, well, do I need to do anything? Do I need to gimmick them? Or, oh, no, just lay them out there. He was the first guy I ever saw take his hand and shoot him straight in, fingers first. He would shoot him straight into the middle of that watermelon and pull the heart out of it.
Sheesh.
Because if you ever looked at his hands, his fingers were all bent where they had been broken and twisted.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, it was awful. But he could take his fingers and he'd just drive it into a watermelon.
Yeah.
Pull the heart out of that melon. Ugh.
I don't know. We lose track of some of those guys from the Orient, the old days. They just go home and we just lose track of them, man. Never see them again or never hear from them. How many times did you go with Luke Hand? What's that? Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jim.
No, I was asking Jerry how many times he went to Japan.
Eight
times?
Yes.
Okay. That's one trip I wish I'd have been able to make, but I just never got invited and never reached that level to be able to go.
It was unbelievable.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievably good or bad?
Good.
Good. I figured you wouldn't go back seven more times if it was unbelievably bad. But
they always took good care of you.
Good. Good. I always heard pretty good stories over there. If the guys behaved themselves, they had a decent time over there without any problems, but...
It was, they treated you with respect. And, I mean, it was first class. Everything was first class. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But you earned your money, let me tell you that.
Really? Really?
Yes. I mean, you went there to work. Yeah, very hard.
Very hard. Did they put you through long matches and stuff
No, it wasn't that. It was just they worked a little bit different than we did. They worked faster, and it was just a different pace.
Yeah,
but it I wouldn't take anything for it.
Yeah,
it was a great experience, and you come back, you're really a better worker.
Really.
Yes.
Well, I've heard pretty much positive stuff of guys going over there. The ones that didn't care for it was the ones that went over there, got drunk, got thrown in jail or something.
Well, I know a lot of guys. I went with what was his name? He was from I can't remember. He said he what was his name? Terry something. Anyhow, he said, I'll never come back over here, man. He was miserable. He was miserable.
Really?
Yeah, he said, man, he said, this is it for me. But, you know, it wasn't for everybody, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Did you guys know Jerry Blackwell when he started in the business? Did he start down there or did he start somewhere else? Because he was from, if I remember right.
He started here. He was from Gainesville, Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah, he was... Tom started using him on Atlanta TV to do jobs. That was back in 70. He worked for Ann Gunkel when we were working for Ann, so it had to be 72, 73.
Okay.
I remember one of the, he was short, and I remember we were on Atlanta TV, and somebody backed him into the ropes, when they backed him in, his butt pushed the middle rope up so that he didn't have anything to support him, and he just sat down. He tripped over the bottom rope, and he sat down onto the apron, and then the middle rope just kind of went over the top of his head, and he fell out backwards, and he went all the way to the floor head first.
Oh,
so
my.
So I was refereeing. I was afraid to go look. I thought he was dead.
Oh.
And I eased over and looked, and he was getting up. He got back in the ring, finished the match. When we come out of the ring, Tom standing there waiting on us when we come through the door, and he went, boy, He said, I thought you was dead. You landed on your head. And I'll never forget Blackwell's remark. He went, eh, Tom, I've always been kind of stout about my neck and shoulders. He said, I'm all right.
gosh.
Yeah, but he promoted some towns, too, up around. He promoted Gainesville and some of those little towns up there, too, when Ann was running. So that's when.
Didn't Jody Hamilton train him?
You know, I don't know.
I have no idea either.
You know, my instinct would say no, not for the time frame involved, but maybe he did.
Uh-huh. Okay. I always wonder what got him, I guess he went to Charlotte after that, then New York, then went out for Vern.
Yeah, he wound up with Vern. That's where he got his break.
Yeah.
He got a good break up there.
Yeah, he did. You know, Jerry, for his size, could do things that you didn't see people his size do.
Yeah.
And he was the biggest guy I ever saw throw a drop kick. They could actually get up and hit a guy in the chest or under the chin.
Yeah.
When he left Charlotte, he worked for Fuller in Knoxville for a while. And then wound up, I think he was part of that when Ronnie Garvin, Bob Roop, and Morris Malenko split off from Fuller and started running opposition. He wound up with them and then worked for Angelo Poffo for a little bit. I think from there he went to New York.
I went into Minneapolis. I'm tapings up there one time. They wanted to take a look at putting him and I together as brothers. And it was Jerry's idea. We never really got far enough, you know, talking with Vern about it. But we wondered to see if I could take any bumps. And holy smokes, I never took so many bumps in two taping hours of wrestling in my life, man. First hour I worked with Hulk Hogan, backdropped me, slammed. They wanted to see if I could take a backdrop, how I looked going up for a slam and all this other kind of stuff. And holy smokes, they had to show him two or three times. And worked with Jim Brunzell and Greg Gagne after that. But Blackwell and I had kind of hooked up in St. Louis, got to talking about that. And he wanted to have Vern take a look at me up there. But it was right after that Ken Patera got fired up in New York for drugs. And went back home to Minneapolis. And that's when Vern put him and Blackwell together as the Sheiks. I don't know if you remember that gimmick or not. So,
yeah, that was when they were working with Ed Van Casey, right?
Yep. I was back in Ohio for newspaper work again.
Well, in going through your results there, a couple of names jumped out at me because they were regulars here in the Gulf Coast. And I know and Jerry and Bobby are familiar with both of them. I just want to see if you remembered working with them and get your impressions on them, Ken Lucas and Greg Peterson.
Yeah, I sure do. I worked with Greg Peterson several times, for some reason they put me over him, and I'm not sure exactly why they did that. It was towards the end of Greg's career, and the working time and stuff, and I don't know why they did that, because they weren't really doing anything with me either, but he was great to work with. And it was night off. You just listen. You know, all you had to do is listen. And he'd pull you right through it, man. And that was good. Now, didn't him and his wife pass away pretty close to each other?
They died within a month of each other, Bobby.
Yeah, they were. It was within. It might have been shorter than that. Yeah, it was very close.
Yeah, I really like. He was a down to earth guy too, man. I mean, it was. You know, he didn't see any attitude or anything with him. He's the kind of guy you'd like next door to, actually. Ken Lucas, I worked with him, I think, in Florida. I can't, I don't, can't remember right off, but or Georgia maybe, but he was the same way, just nice and smooth and good. And I don't recall him as much as I do Greg, but he was a decent worker. I really, you know, I like time with him. And again, you know, it's a nice night off working with guys like that.
This one is fun.
Yeah.
The hardest thing I ever had working with him was he talked so fast I could hardly catch the spots he was calling. But if you ever invite you over for dinner, don't go, right, Jerry?
Don't go.
What's that?
Dinner.
I said, if Lucas ever invites you over to his house for dinner, don't go. He got Jerry.
Okay.
My wife and I went over at about 7 o'clock, and we didn't eat till 3 that morning.
Really?
He said, yeah, he was waiting for, I mean, he was running a scam, you know. He did, and my wife finally said, she said, I'm about to die. And so I finally said, kid, and we go, he said, oh, yeah, I was just waiting for y'all to say something. So how did that thing go for Orndorff?
I don't know.
I never have heard any more about it. I haven't heard any more about it.
Is he living in Atlanta now?
He lives in Fayette County, just south of Atlanta.
Fayette County. Yeah.
Okay.
He's the last picture I saw of him, man. He's just a shell of what he used to be. He's in a pretty bad way.
And you know, us guys, the few of us that even made any money in this business. If we had anyone who got out, we spent it all on medical bills, man. That's
a fact.
Yeah, you know, that we're facing. But, guys that worked a lot longer got a heck of a lot more injured than I got. I want to ask you guys, too. You guys probably know this. Joe Zaharko, was he originally from Jordan? Was he down your way? Joe Scarpa.
I don't know.
Scarpa.
He lives here. He lives in Griffin.
Still does.
Okay.
I'm not sure if he was. I don't know where Joe was originally from.
I know he lived for years here in Mobile. He first came into Mobile in the late 50s when Buddy Fuller was still promoting here. And he actually, at that time, Buddy Fuller owned a large ranch with several houses on it out over across Mobile Bay what's the name of the little town? Loxley. I think that's it. But and Scarpa lived there on the ranch. And then when Buddy sold his promotion to his cousin Lee Fields, he sold the ranch along with it too. And all the clippings I've seen of Joe from early in his career, from here they billed him as being from Los Angeles. They claimed he was a former pro football player from Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And then, but when he was in Georgia, they billed him from Mobile, and he was called the Rebel. So, I don't know where he was from. Really.
Yeah. Okay. He's
still living in Griffin.
Lives in Griffin, Georgia.
Okay. Is Lex Luger live in Atlanta, or is he down in Florida?
I think he's in Atlanta.
Last I heard, he was still around here.
Okay. I don't. When we would work for Georgia Wrestling, when they would make those tours up here through Ohio and Michigan, me and Snow and some other guys would go work on their shows. Because what they would do with their travel schedule, they would get to the arena so late that they would have me supply two matches that worked in the openings. And we had to wrestle as long as until the guys got in the dressing room. They'd give us half hour time limits and stuff. And Right, if you have to go 28 minutes, just make sure somebody got their boots on in time out in the back. Talk about boring the fans of that. But I saw Lex up here in Columbus, Ohio one night, and it was just, I really felt sorry for him then. This is back in the 80s, and he was kind of at the peak of that attitude, you know, type of thing he had. And I know he's been through a lot, and I sure hope he's getting things turned around. Sometimes we really have to bottom out before we, you know, get strong enough to turn things around, but I hope
that is a fact.
Yeah,
he has certainly been through it. He has been through it, too.
When was Jim Barnett living down in Atlanta when he passed away?
Yeah, he was living. He was living here. He had a. I had talked to him on the phone maybe a week before he died, and he had. He was always wanting to go to lunch. You know, come on up, Mr. Bobby. We'll go to lunch one day. Okay. Well, you know, and it just never materialized. He was always too busy. And I found out later on, of course, Jim's eyesight had gotten so bad he could barely see. And yeah. even though he had gotten to that point, he was in, and he was just very vain. He didn't want anybody to see him that way. But he fell and broke his arm.
Really?
And they put him in a hospital. Mm-hmm. And I had called and couldn't find him, didn't know where he was, and then somebody told me he was in the hospital. And when I called the hospital, they told me he had passed away. So he developed pneumonia. From the when he broke the arm, they put him in the hospital. He developed pneumonia and he passed away. Happened pretty quick.
Yeah. Was he buried down there, or did they?
They cremated him. And his it was. I worked for the man for a lot of years, and uh-huh. he was very good to me and my family. But he was. I did not know he was Jewish until the day of his memorial service when they had a rabbi do the service. But at his memorial service, there was only maybe 20 people showed up, and it was one of the, and I can't remember the gentleman's name. He worked for Ted Turner for a long time. He had kind of took the responsibility of not taking care of Jim, but of just checking on him, making sure he was in, you know, doing all right. He'd take him out to eat once or twice a week, and just him and his wife would take him out. But he told me that day after it was all over, because I was kind of curious what they were going to do, and he said that Jim was such an avid baseball fan that he was going to take his ashes down to Turner Field here in Atlanta and spread them out around the ballpark. So I'm assuming that's what he did. So kind of a sad ending to a guy. Yeah. A lot of tales about Jim Barnett, but Jim Barnett was a pretty good guy.
I only met him one time while I was working down there. And it was very... I could put the wrestling club, that's for sure.
Yeah, he certainly was successful. Every territory he ever touched made money.
Yep. Yeah, he had that knack, that's for sure. How long did you work for him, Bobby?
I went to work for Jim in November of 1974, and I went over as a referee and putting the ring up, and I was helping around the box office, and I did that until middle of 76, early 77, and then Doug Smith decided he wanted out of the business, and I became his office manager, and I stayed there until 83. And in 83 is when Ole decided they did the takeover, and when Barnett pulled out, Ole knew where my loyalty was, and I walked in. Ole says he fired me. I say I quit. Guess it depends on which side of that desk he was on. But it was time for me to go. So I left there in 83. And, of course, Barnett left, went to New York, working for McMahon as part of his controller's office and taking care of the money and so forth. And
yeah.
We stayed in touch over the years just talking, but... I guess total, I worked for him for about 9 years total.
Yeah. Well, you certainly worked for one of the icons, that's for sure.
Well, he was good to me, and I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I learned how to run a promotion, who to take care of, and how to take care of them in such a fashion that it made money, and then I watched Ole destroy it all in a matter of about 3 years.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Guys like that can get power. And just really kind of have that selfish look to things, man. Just turn up the trip for sure.
Yeah. You were talking about the guys getting to those towns so late up north and their travel schedules. When we first started doing that, when we first started doing those tours, of course, I was still there and Barnett was still running the thing. Man, we had that thing so late. That was such a sweet deal. I don't know what's happening now, but we rented those guys Lincoln Continental Town cars. We flew them into Columbus on Sunday. And, of course, the tours always started in Columbus on Sunday nights. We rented them Lincoln Continental Town cars to travel in. Jim gave them a per diem to eat on every day. Flew them home at the end of the tour to make Atlanta TV, and they were making megabucks.
Yeah.
And then it went from that to when we were no longer doing it to hoping the guys showed up on time to work the third match. So.
Yeah.
Kind of sad.
Yeah, it was. J.J. Dillon was the one who always called me to set things up and get guys for towns and stuff like that. Was he working with the Andersons at that time?
See, Ole took the thing over. See, Gene was out of the picture at that point. It was Ole and Ole's right-hand man was Ralph Freed, which was Fred Ward's son-in-law. And then he brought when I left the office, when I left, me and Ronnie West were the only two people working in the office. A week after I left, there was five people doing what me and Ronnie had been doing for years.
Jeez.
And J.J. could have been working, helping coordinate some things, I'm not sure. I know he had Bob Roop doing it for a while. He had he brought Leo Garibaldi in for a while to give some ideas. And
Les was there for a while. Les Thatcher was there for a while.
I mean, he had a lot of people in and out of there. You know, Jerry Briscoe ran some towns for a while, and it was just, you know, nobody could work for him very long because they'd wind up quitting or getting fired or, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell you, it's, you know, everybody talks about, you know, Vince taking over the industry and, you know, what he's turned it into today and all this other kind of stuff. But I'm not so convinced that the wrestling business wasn't headed towards its own death anyway, the territories at the time, because of, you know, if you look, all the owners of the territories and the bookers and everything were all from that same generation. You know, you had Fritz Von Erich, you had the Sheik. And Geigel out in Kansas City and all that other kind of stuff. And all of those guys were coming to the end of their careers and time all at the same time, and I guess it just never bought into the idea that cable TV was gonna happen. And I think they were doomed anyway from the way I know Sheik went out of business before Vince was even heard of. He was done. His last Cobo show was October 1980. That's one Bobo Brazil walked out on. And, I never thought I'd see that or hear that, but that was the end of that deal. But he was long gone before anybody decided to go national.
When did you guys start running the Northern Tour, Bobby?
81? Michael, I'm real bad with years and dates. It would have been 80 or 81, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Because when you guys first started going, especially in Michigan and all that, you were doing it in cooperation with Farhead, right?
Well, the first show we ran was Columbus, Ohio. And the reason we ran Columbus, Ohio, and here again, and just real quickly and in a nutshell, if you remember the deal Watts did when he was booking where he did the champion of champion deals, and he told the fans, send in your cards and letters and tell us, you know, what you think about this and blah, 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 blah. Well, Randy Corin, whom y'all know and is my friend, and I got him a job bearing the ticket office in Atlanta. Randy's job for the next 2 weeks, the mailman would back up in a truck at the arena, and he would unload these big, huge mail sacks with probably 50 pounds of mail in each sack. And it wasn't nothing for them to dump 10, 12 bags of mail out in our lobby over there a day. And all Randy did was open these bags, and he never opened the envelopes. All he did was look at the postmark to see where they were coming from, because this was coming off the satellite at 17. And the biggest majority of the letters we got came from that Columbus, Ohio area. So that's the reason we ran Columbus, Ohio. That's the reason we went up there to run that thing on a Sunday night. Now, on that Sunday afternoon, about 12:30, at a little restaurant on top of the Regency Hyatt House Hotel there, right in the Ohio Center, Barnett met with the Sheik. And I sat on the other side of the room as a witness just to see the thing happen. But Barnett paid Eddie for running that town. Even though he wasn't doing anything, he wasn't running anything at the time, Barnett paid him out of respect to the fact that that was his town and that was NWA old school, that you didn't step on another promoter.
Yeah.
So we ran that show that night. We sold that building out. It was the first night. The Ohio Center opened that weekend. I drove up there with the ring that Saturday. And that Saturday night they had Conway Twitty and Jerry Lee Lewis and somebody else was the first event in the building, and they did about a half a house. We sold out our first show on Sunday night in 13 minutes.
Oh, my.
13 minutes we sold that building out, 8,000-something people. And we ran that. We ran it about three times, and then the Sheik decided he wanted to he Barnett worked a deal with him to send four of our guys to run Columbus on Sunday night and then send four of our guys over and run Parkersburg, West Virginia on Monday night and then go to Huntington, West Virginia on Tuesday night. And first time we went, the deal was we split the houses in half, right down the middle. We split them. The first time we went, everything went real well. Wasn't any problem at all. It was me wrestling two, Ted DiBiase. First trip was Ole Anderson, Saito, Kevin Sullivan. That was and me. There was four of us. Everything went fine. About a month later, same deal. Me wrestling two and Ted DiBiase, and the Sheik stole the houses. He took the money and ran. And that was the end of the working agreement, and that's when we started running Michigan and the other places. And there's been a lot of stories out about why that happened, but that's the gospel truth as I'm sitting here. But
well, it sure doesn't surprise me, that's for sure.
No. We ran Huntington, West Virginia on that Tuesday night with Wrestling 2 and DiBiase. The poor guys the Sheik were sending, it was probably, and I may be wrong, but I'm thinking it was like a 400-mile trip from Detroit down there. These guys are sleeping 9 to a hotel room. They're putting mattresses on the floor, box springs on the floor, because they're starving to death. They're not making any money, but they love the business that much that they made the trip. And he came to me that night in Huntington, and he said, Bobby, he said, I don't have a ring announcer. Would you do the ring announcing? I said, well, sure. Well, while I'm in the ring doing the ring announcing, he sends his girlfriend to the box office, and she checks up. Well, when the guy from the building comes down to me, because he knew the deal, he told me, he said, Bobby, I had no choice because the contract was in his name. And I said, okay. And when I called, but Barnett was in Texas for something that night, and I called him at Houston, Texas, at an airport, there, at a hotel there at the airport. And I remember him telling me on the phone, he said, well, somebody will have to get fired over this, and he said, it'll probably be you. And I remember walking back in the dressing room, and I told the Sheik, I said, well, you cost me my job tonight. And I said, just remember what goes around comes around. And the only time I was ever able to get even with him, and it was just a little bit, I didn't really do anything, but he came into Atlanta to work a deal with Abdul at the Omni, and he always wanted his trans in cash that night. For some reason, I wasn't around. I can't remember what happened, but I just never went to the dressing room that night. But, that kind of stuff went on a lot. And it's like I say, when he died and all this stuff was on the Internet about what a great person he was, and I'm sure he was to certain people, but You know, I mean, this wasn't the guy that I did business with. The guy I did business with would lie to your face, and he'd steal from you, and it was just a bad situation.
Well, when he got out of business around here, man, I tell you, no TV station would talk to you, because I tried to get, you know, our little promotion. I was trying to find some airtime someplace, and, man, they talk about, you want to pay the bill from Big Time Wrestling, that's what Sheik's promotion was called, but he says, you want to pay the bill from what they owe me, you know, we'll talk, but until then, you know, he'd owe a TV station, you know, it'd be $400 or $500 one place, $800 the next, you know, some other place,
yeah,
and all this other kind of stuff. But he just left that whole thing in the wake, and, you know, we didn't have the big talent, we didn't have anything that, you know, could gain any interest, so...
Well, he was living in that huge house in Detroit, and other than the select few, maybe like Bobo or whoever, those guys, those poor guys were starving to death. I mean, it was really sad. I mean, I remember the first night in Parkersburg, I told Kevin Sullivan in the dressing room, I said, look, man, I got a room over here with two double beds. You're welcome to stay with me tonight. And he said, no, he said, I'm going to stay with the Sheik's guys. He said, I'm going to try to help them out. And me and Ole and Saito went somewhere and grabbed a pizza and went to the hotel, and I was sitting in a room. You know, I can remember sitting in the bed watching Johnny Carson, and it was probably 12:45. Knock on the door. I opened the door, and when I opened the door, Kevin Sullivan kissed me right in the mouth. And I said, what was that for? And he says, I am so glad to see you. He said, and he described the conditions, how that the guys would take the mattresses and the pillows, and he said, nine guys in a room. He said, because they could not afford. He said, man, they're eating sardines and soda crackers. He said, they can't afford nothing else. He said, because they got to have gas money to get home, and they don't know if they'll get any money tomorrow night.
Yeah.
So just really sad.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we are at the point in our show where we do our Gary Oates Natural Products Name of the Week, and this is actually one that Jim mentioned earlier in the show, Dean Ho.
The only place I was around Dean Ho was here in Georgia, and he was a super nice guy. Never wrestled him, but I enjoyed being around him.
I saw Dean at the Cauliflower Alley Club 2 years ago. Other than a little gray around the temples, he has not changed a bit. Still has that great smile, still got that great sense of humor.
Bobby, was you working with the Georgia office when he was here?
Yes. Yes.
He's a nice guy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Him and Tony Garea came in from New York as a tag team. And they used him as a team here for a while, and then Tony left, and Dean stayed here a little longer than Tony did. One thing I remember about Dean most of all was he had a weak stomach.
There you go. That's what I was
saying. Oh, a very weak stomach. We were in a little spot show one night where we had him outnumbered. You know, we've all had those nights. And,
yeah,
and he was working with Ted Heath, and Ted Heath was under a mask. And, you know, first match, you know, we're just out there going through the motions. And Ted Heath tells me, he says, look, he said, I'm going to take him down. He said, when I take him down, he said, you drop down there and get close. He said, I want to show you something. I said, well, okay. So he did something, and he Dean's down on his back, and Ted goes down, and I flopped down, got close, and when I did, Ted winked at me, and he leaned over, and he kissed Dean right in the mouth. And when he did, Dean rolled over like a G.I. Joe Army man, crawled on his elbows to the edge of the ring, and threw up. Oh, and that was probably the high spot of the evening.
he didn't like the sight of blood either, did he? Somewhere along the line, I heard that about him, that he, because of his weak stomach, he couldn't stand the sight of blood.
I don't know. I don't remember that much about blood with him. I know another guy from Hawaii, Koa Tiki, he couldn't stand blood.
Tiki was unbelievable.
Oh, Koa Tiki, man, somebody cut him one night, and he seen his own blood, and he fainted in the ring. Oh, yeah.
That may
he
be
could,
who I'm thinking of.
Yeah, he couldn't stand it.
Where's Dean living, Bobby?
He lives in Washington, Seattle, in that area up there.
Love you, dog.
He goes to Dean Silverstone, gentleman that promoted out there some there, he goes to his reunion every August. But he was honored by Cauliflower Alley last year, I believe it was, when I saw him.
Yeah, Dean was a good guy.
Yes, he was.
Well, guys, we are down to the last few minutes here. I want to thank Jim for joining us. Some great stories, and Jim, we're going to definitely have to have you back on. And appreciate Tom Ernesto Jr. and Greg Lake. I wish Greg had stayed on. I'd like to talk to him a little bit more because Greg had had a good career as well. He worked in here, worked in Florida, worked in Georgia. Like Jim, he worked all over the place. And he worked out there for Dean Silverstone in Seattle. He and Dean were very close. In fact, how he got out to Seattle is because of Bobby Shane sending him out there. And back earlier in his career, he looked like he looked almost like Bobby's cousin or twin brother, except he was a little bit shorter than Bobby. He was a little bit smaller than Bobby, but other than that, he had passed his twin. But not sure what about the show next week. As far as I know, we're going to do it. I'm not sure where I will be. I know I'm going to be down in South Florida the early part of the week, because as I was telling Bobby and Jerry before we got on the air tonight, I have a meeting with Cole Brothers Circus to talk to them about going to work for them. And if that's the case, I'm not sure where they'll send me from there. If they decide to give me the privilege of coming to work for them, which I'll find out Tuesday. Not sure where I'll be, but I'm not planning on it changing anything as far as the shows will go. I'll have my laptop and my cell phone with me, so let's just...
only thing I can tell you, Mike, to help you with your interview, tell them you have a Canon rider available. And that might help you. You bring your own Canon rider.
I guess I've ruled out. I'm not going to wear my Cumley T-shirt.
Please don't. I love Cumley, but don't wear the shirt.
But like I said, I am planning. I talked to Dick Steinborn, and he definitely wants to be back with us again. He's nowhere near out of stories.
No.
We'll definitely have him on in the future. Been talking to Scott Teal. Scott's going to do another show with us here coming up in the next few weeks or so. And we're just trying to line up as many folks as I can to keep this ball rolling. I think we've done a real good job with it. And
I enjoy it.
Having folks like Jim on here just helps a lot. You know, I certainly do. Again, I appreciate you coming on. And
I'm glad you
know what our show's about, man.
Well, I was kind of surprised because, you know, I'm such a small player in this business, and I was in it full-time for such a short period of time. And I do appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and reminisce about the old days. I don't get that opportunity much anymore, but I really appreciate you having me on, and it's a real blessing.
Well, Jim, this is Jerry, and I hope the future goes well for you. And don't underestimate yourself about what you did in the business. Don't ever do that.
Yeah. Well, we got high hopes, Jerry. I appreciate those words.
Jim, it was a pleasure hearing your voice. I told my wife before I went on the air, and I said, I'm going to hear from somebody I hadn't talked to in 35 years, and I said, I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad we're still around and we can still talk about those great days, man. It was. I'm glad that you may know, you may not know. I have been pastoring a Baptist church here in Atlanta for the last 21 years. So it does my heart good to hear someone talk about their faith and how the good Lord's taking care of them. Because trust me, when all else fails, He will take
care
of you.
Absolutely. Sure. I can't think of a better way to end the show, folks.
That's a fact.
Guys, we'll talk to you guys next week. I'll touch base with you guys once I know for sure what's going on with me, Bobby and Jerry, and
And I hope things go good for you, Mike. I hope things go great for
you. I hope so, too. I hope so, too.
Yeah, they'll be good, Mike. Just remember, Bozo is copyrighted. You'll have to come up with something else.
All right, guys. We'll get Jim again. I appreciate it. And we will get together next week, and we'll do this again.
Thanks, guys. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Good night, guys.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.